Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, we hear from a Japanese-American about his first visit in 78 years to the site of the Fresno Assembly Center. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Alice Daniel. We also meet some high school seniors who plan to be the first in their families to attend college. They tell us how one program is guiding them. And we replay an interview with writer Mark Arax on his new book, The Dreamt Land. It's getting high praise.
But first, a recap of this week's news. A Fresno County Sheriff's deputy is recovering after being shot in the leg Tuesday. 49-year-old John Erickson was responding to a Foothills property dispute.
When deputies arrived on scene, they started taking fire from what they describe as rifle shots.
That's Sheriff Margaret Mims. Following an armed standoff that lasted for several hours, the gunman, 57-year-old Michael James Congdon, was taken into custody. He's now facing two charges for attempted murder, one against Erickson, the other against his civilian ride-along.
The unincorporated community of Lanier, a longtime poster child for California's contaminated drinking water, finally got a passing grade for its water this spring after state grants paid for two new wells. It's the first time arsenic has been below the state limit since 2006.
Just yesterday, a 6.4 magnitude earthquake rattled California residents from Los Angeles to Fresno. The epicenter was near the eastern Kern County community of Ridgecrest, which Governor Gavin Newsom declared under a state of emergency. There were several reports of damage and structure fires in that city. The U.S. Geological Survey says at least 30 aftershocks followed the main quake, and more are likely in the same area over the next week.
More than 100 people gathered around Congressman Devin Nunes' Clovis office Thursday to join the nationwide protest to shut down immigration detention centers. The hashtag Close the Camps protest is in response to the inhumane conditions Democrats in Congress described while visiting centers along the southern border.
Also this week, new research out of the University of California tried to determine just why the state's prolonged drought that ended in 2015 led to the deaths of nearly 150 million trees in the Sierra Nevada. After all, California's forests typically survive droughts. The culprit this time? The drought's intensity, likely fueled by climate change, dried out the soil, even deep below the surface. Here's Roger Bales, director of UC Merced's Sierra Nevada Research Institute and the senior author on the study.
So every year the trees drew water from a little bit deeper down, and when it rained or snowed and snow melted, it replenished the upper part of the soil, but not the deeper part.
The solution for the future, he says, is to thin the state's forest to reduce overcrowding before the next big drought. Listen for more FM 89 news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. This week, a Japanese-American from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, visited Fresno for the first time in 78 years. In 1942, Walter Imahara and his family were ordered to leave their home in Sacramento and come to the Fresno Assembly Center, per President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066. The family was then sent to an internment camp in Arkansas. I spoke to Imahara at the Fresno County Historical Museum, along with Fresno resident and Shinsen Garden designer Paul Saito, who was also interned when he was a child. We'll start with Imahara explaining what it was like for his father to leave Sacramento.
So he was ordered to come here to report, and he lost his 60-acre farm. So when he got here, he had seven children. I was like 4 years old, so when you have your parents, things aren't so bad, okay? But the parents are the one that carry the burden, yeah. But I can remember just the horse stable and things like that, but as children, it's not super bad.
Seeing what the Fresno Fairgrounds is now and this sort of memorial, I mean, what's kind of going through your head today, revisiting it for the first time?
You know, when I drive through this Fresno area, of course, I can't believe the change. Because in my mind, it was just horse track, huh? Because we went from here to Arkansas. So all these years that have passed, and I got an opportunity that they're going to put a program together where I can come visit. So everything is, to me, new.
Paul, I know you were interned, or I understand you were interned also at Arkansas, same as Walter, right? Did you guys ever cross paths?
I don't know if we were only 5 years old, so I might have seen him, but I don't know. We were probably in the same class, but I don't even know who my classmates were.
But that, I think, kind of really speaks to how it became its own community, all of the camps, right? Is that kind of how you remember it, even though you were so young?
Well, I was from Los Angeles area, so we went to a different assembly center. We were sent to Santa Anita Racetrack, where we lived in horse stables like they did here. Then we were taken on a long train ride back to Arkansas. We lived in that sultry area and remembering all the bad things, like the chiggers and the ticks and all these other mosquitoes. It was pretty horrible living there. But it was kind of different living with all Japanese people. Well, we're used to living with all Caucasian people. So it's an adjustment to live just with our own race.
Right, and a completely different culture and a place you didn't choose. One thing I wanted to ask is, this week is 4th of July is going on. Do you recall maybe celebrating that holiday while you guys were in camp?
Not really. But I was here in Sacramento about 2 years ago. And at that time, it was like, I mentioned it to a guest. I said, last time I had 4th of July was in 1941. And here it is, so, you know, like 75 years later, I'm having 4th of July in Sacramento again. So there's a big time span. And so to go from childhood to today, it was a very emotional time, yeah. The time was so long.
And being that, you know, people treat this holiday as like celebrating patriotism and freedom. I mean, when you think about the experience you've had living in camp, and maybe Paul, you could talk about this too, do you feel like you have a different view on that compared to maybe other Americans who didn't have that same experience?
I think we've got a better view. I have friends at the coffee shops, and they talk bad about what's wrong with America. And I stopped them first. I said, you know, America is the best country in the world. I said, but before I ask, how many of you been in the service? And just maybe a couple of hands go up. I said, most of you know my background. I was 3.5 years in a concentration camp, 3.5 years, and I ended up as an officer in the same uniform that guarded us 20 years ago. I said, now let me remind everybody that we are very loyal Americans. And when my parents went to Louisiana to educate the nine children, eight of us got college education. That's how we did it. But the best story is there's four boys. I'm the oldest. We all joined the military. We joined because the parents says, after we got our college, what service are you going into? I said, well, I'll go to Army. I'll go to OCS. Okay, so we're very loyal. So I don't like it when somebody talks bad about America.
So even having the experience of being in the camps where the government, you know, incarcerated Japanese Americans, for you, that hasn't made your loyalty waver at all?
No, not one bit. We all knew it was a period. We knew why we were in camp, but as a child, it didn't matter. But as a grown-up, as we came through, we knew it was part of our life, but we couldn't carry it with us. You know, there's a Japanese word, shigatanai, means you got to let it go. And you can see of the Japanese that came out of camp, the parents of the children, they all pushed education and get over it, get on with life. And in general, we all have.
Paul, same question to you. I mean, having had this experience, do you feel the same way as Walter, where you just feel still very loyal and understand that that's just how things were?
Yes, I feel the same way Walter does. In fact, I joined the Air Force as soon as I graduated college. So I spent my time in Texas doing basic training, which was terrible. But anyway, so I served 6 years in the reserves. And after I got out, then I went into my profession, and like he says, our parents, they insisted that we go to college. And so both my sisters and I, both of us graduated from college and went into our respective professions. And that's how we succeeded.
Having looked at this museum, lived the lives you all have lived, how are you feeling about the state of, ultimately the state of the government? Are you optimistic that things are going well right now? Or, I mean, looking at these, you know, detained migrants and the possibility of housing migrants in a former camp, I don't know, how does that make you feel right now?
It doesn't, but my outlook is so different than an average American walking the streets that we you know, there's a lot of things wrong with America. Okay, but we just said, but there's so many great things. So myself, living in Louisiana, and when the Japanese-American family get together, you know how many they are in Louisiana? About the number of people here. There isn't any, okay? But all my brothers and sisters, once they got educated, they left Louisiana. I stayed there because I love Louisiana. And I was in a horticulture, so I went in nursery business, okay? But all my life, I always thought that this country is still great. We celebrate 4th of July. And recently, I was on a talk show in Baton Rouge about a week ago, and they want to talk about the reparation that, what is my thoughts about it, because now there's a front moving toward a group of people. And so before I went, I found the letter of apology that we received in 1990 with a copy of the check, and I gave it to the speaker, the radio announcer. He was astonished. He knew a lot about the Japanese American, but he'd never seen this. So he read the whole story about the apology, and he mentioned by President George Bush. Then he said, I have a copy of the check, okay, $20,000. So he says, so what is your thoughts on that? I said, the letter of apology was what we needed. It was not the check, okay? So you could see, and I told my father received it, and all he did was cry.
That was Walter Imahara and Paul Saito, both of whom I spoke with at the Fresno County Historical Museum.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. Going to college is hard enough, but what if no one in your family can tell you how to study or choose classes or fill out financial aid forms or even apply in the first place because they've never been? Well, a federal program called Upward Bound helps high school students become the first in their families to go to college. Moderator Kathleen Schock talks with Fresno City College's Upward Bound director, Ben Reynoso, and students Anissa Brown, Elisha Mendoza, and Angie Gonzalez-Barajas.
So, Ben, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about your background with Upward Bound and with TRIO in general. Tell us what TRIO is and how Upward Bound fits under that umbrella.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Kathleen, first off, for having us here today. And as you mentioned, TRIO programs have been around since 1964. We began in the Lyndon B. Johnson administration. It was a program to help students who are first generation and low income to go to college. One of the programs, and actually the initial program, was Upward Bound. And today we have students here from different high schools who fall under Upward Bound because they are first generation and come from low-income families. They qualify for this program. At Fresno City, we are one of 890 TRIO Upward Bound programs. Our program specifically has 89 students from the Central Valley, five different high schools that we're at, and we basically just help them to go to college. We make them, empower them, give them those opportunities that they know that college is a reality for them.
Great. So let's hear from some of our students who are here today. Anisha, let's start with you. So tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to Upward Bound, and what your experiences have been in the program.
So I was initiated into the program by one of my school counselors, and she just pulled me into the class when she went over my my transcript with me, and she was telling me about like my grades and how good they were, and that was I interested in college. And I had told her I've been interested in college since I was like little, like I've always wanted to. So
and how old were you when you had this conversation?
When I got initiated into the I was probably, I was a sophomore, actually. So I was going into my sophomore year. So I was a freshman at the time when she had talked to me. And the conversation went really smooth. She handed me a package. She said that she was excited to inform me that, like, I got accepted into the program.
What are the kind of things that you've done as part of Upward Bound?
Upward Bound, we go on college trips, and they just give us a reality check, like, this is how, like, college is. So we're also in classes, and we're, like, doing college stuff. We're actually getting college credit. The class that I'm in is Allied Health, and we're actually with a professor from Fresno City. So it's real-life stuff, and it's hands-on, so we're always working, we're always doing something. And it's not just work, work, work. We actually have fun all the time. We go on field trips every Friday. Actually, this weekend, we're going to San Francisco to visit two colleges.
How exciting. So, Alicia, I want to switch to you. Tell me a little bit about your experience in Upward Bound and how it has shaped your thinking about your future.
Well, Upward Bound has definitely helped me think a lot more about the future than I think I would have if I had not been in it. I remember my friend Daisy pulled me in one day and she was like, hey, do you want to do a summer program with me? It's through Upward Bound. And I was like, what's that? And she was like, well, it basically helps you get exposure for college and get ready. And it's for, like, income students like us, because we don't really have a lot of people to talk about things like that. So I was like, okay, yeah, I'm down. And I joined last summer and it just really changed my life. Like, I actually started thinking, wow, I have opportunities, because where I come from, it's really, you're just going to work for the rest of your life. That's all you're going to have to do. And that's how you're going to support yourself. And so I was like, okay, I guess that's it. But now I know I can go to college. I can major in what I love, which is chemistry. And Upward Bound actually helped me find that, because we have tutoring sessions during the school year. And I was struggling with chemistry. And I was like, man, I can't do this because I'm not good at it. But the tutors there, they taught me, you don't have to be good at it to like it. You don't have to be good at it to get into it. You just have to work hard. And I think that's what Upward Bound does. It gives you a reality check, but it also helps you. Like, it just doesn't, like, give you tough love. Like, it actually gives you the materials and the resources to help support what you want to do. And that's what I love about Upward Bound. And it's really influenced me to go to college. And it gave me the confidence to say now that I want to go to UC Davis.
That's extraordinary. Fingers crossed that you get that admission packet in the mail next year. And just to mention, you are a senior at Edison High School currently, correct?
Yes, I'm going into my senior year.
Wonderful. So, Ben, I'd like to shift the focus back to you. As you mentioned, Upward Bound is a program that has been around a very long time, and all of the research indicates that it is extremely successful. I'm wondering, from your perspective, what is it that is so unique about this program in terms of the impact that it has for students?
Yeah. I think definitely it's that individual attention that we give our students. So it gives us the opportunity. We have 87 students. So for that counselor to work with that student the 4 years that they're in high school, it really gives us that starting point as a freshman all the way to senior year to know what they want to see themselves doing later on in life, and empower them to believe in themselves. And so, like, for example, like Anissa, you know, now that we know that she wants to go to CSU Long Beach, then let's plan that college visit to CSU Long Beach. She wants to go into communications. Let's expose her to people in communications. And again, you know, they're going to be going through teenage, you know, issues or stuff, you know, at home or, you know, in school. And we really just try to make sure that they know that there's people that will support them regardless of whatever they're going on with in their lives.
Great. If you're joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're discussing the Upward Bound program at Fresno City College, and we're joined by the director of that program, along with several students and an alumni of the program. So, Angie, I'd like to bring you into this conversation. You are currently a senior at Fresno State. But you went through the Upward Bound program when you were in high school and now have come back as a tutor in that program. So tell us a little bit about why this program was meaningful for you and what the experience has been to come back and work with these high school students.
Well, thank you so much, first of all, for having us here. We really appreciate it. But yeah, so I was actually an alumni from the program. I actually started back in 2011. I'm actually the oldest in my family and the first one on both sides to be attending a university. So it's a huge, huge deal. So Upward Bound, actually, I feel like it was just kind of that like, I was lucky. I was lucky enough to be able to be a part of something so tremendous that has helped me become essentially who I am today. My family never thought of the idea of college. I never really was exposed to anything in regards to college. So when Upward Bound reached out to me, it was actually at Ahwahnee Middle School. And they pulled me out of class. I honestly thought I was in trouble. I was like, I'm doing all my homework. I'm doing everything great. They did a presentation. And I was like, this is too real to be like true, right? And it's all free. Like, you know, who's paying for this? So when I told my dad, he's like, well, you know, let's see if this is actually the real deal. So he confirmed, I joined. And honestly, it's been a step that I'm so grateful for. So Upward Bound has really supported me in ways I never knew to ever exist, from mentoring us to providing us workshops to bringing in guest speakers to visiting university campuses to providing you with financial aid, how to fill it out, what to expect in college. I think the tutoring definitely does work. And, you know, here I am kind of having this conversation with us today. It's really nice to be able to be to have formed a part of it and now becoming an alumni, but also giving back. And I think for me, Upward Bound means so much because it gave me that gateway. It gave me that opportunity to become something without really knowing that I could. And so to be working for them, for me, it's an honor. Like, that's not so much of having to, I don't see it as a job. Let me just kind of state that. I don't see it as a job. I see it like I get to give back to some students who I knew that I've come from kind of their upbringing, and to provide those resources to give out workshop presentations. Now it's like, wow, I never thought I would be a tutor. As a matter of fact, our assistant director was actually my tutor when I was in the program. And so it's really nice to see, like, past students come back and help and support. And it's just a beauty to be able to kind of share this and not just, you know, let it die essentially. So.
And Anisha, what is it like for you to have somebody who is had such similar experience to yours as a tutor and also, I would imagine, a bit of a mentor?
Having a tutor is, like, honestly the greatest thing that I could have because I'm the youngest in my family, and it's just a great extra help. Like, they help me and they provide for me too, so it's never a dull moment. So I feel like they're actually like my family. So since I've been here in the program, they've always been there for me, and I can always talk to Angie about anything and Ben about anything. I connect with the program really well, so I think it's a great thing because I'm the youngest in my family, and my other I have an older sister and an older brother, but they're not really like on the like school side. So when I come to the program, I have other people around me that are like me. So
that's great. Thank you. So, Ben, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the things that I think is a bit unique about Upward Bound is that you have a lot of autonomy to shape the program. Mm-hmm. Even though the money is coming from the federal government, they're not necessarily mandating how those dollars are spent. And mm-hmm. I understand that Fresno City College has implemented 4 new areas this mm-hmm. year. Tell us a little bit about how the program is growing and changing mm-hmm. and how you're tailoring it to meet the specific needs of students.
Yeah, one of the things that we tried this year, and I think it was really successful, was the students were able to stay in the dorms for a week, the first week of summer program. So they stayed at Fresno State. And this was important for us to implement because a lot of times these students want to go away from home, go to college to another state or another city. And by them staying in the dorms, they're able to prove to their parents, to their family members that, hey, you know what? I was able to do this. I was able to live alone. I was able to live the college lifestyle for a week. I definitely can do it once that time comes. This year, we implemented internships. So these young ladies here, they were able to have their first job, learn those soft skills that a lot of times, you know, teenagers their age don't have yet. And so it's everything from being respectful to your boss, showing up on time, how to answer phones. I mean, everything that first job should entail, we're trying to teach them and teach them in the right way. Our campus, again, is offering courses for them, the dual enrollment high school enrichment. Again, they're getting college credit. And so for us, it's like really implementing it and drilling it in their mind that, yes, they come from first generation low income families, but that shouldn't be the burden as to why they should not go away to college or go to college.
And just for those who are not familiar, dual enrollment means a college course at Fresno City College that high school students are enrolled in?
Correct, yes. Mm-hmm.
So you've been involved, I'm turning the conversation now to Alicia. Yeah, tell us a little bit about some of these experiences. Were you Did you stay at Fresno State in the dorms? Have you been taking dual enrollment courses? What have you been able to engage in?
Yeah, I actually loved my stay at Fresno State in the dorms because I felt it wasn't only proving to like my parent that I could do it. It was proving to myself that I could do it, like going on alone, having a roommate, not really just knowing what is going to happen. Because, I mean, they gave us an idea, but still, like, you're away from home, you're out of your comfort zone. And I honestly loved it. Like, it made me think, wow, I actually do want to go to Davis. Like, if I do go to Davis, I want to stay in the dorms. This is amazing. I love it. It just gave me relief. And they helped us even talk about if you do want to move away, like, what's going to happen. So I loved that so much. And especially the internships this year. I personally love my job. It's actually really amazing. And I've gotten really a lot of exposure with the program, not only to college, but yeah, with the internship to like how the workforce is going to be for me, which actually made me go out and apply for another job on my own because I knew I had the support of Upward Bound behind me. And they were actually there when I got the call back saying I had gotten the job. So it was actually a really great moment for me.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So Angie, looking back on your time with Upward Bound and certainly from the perspective that you're in now as somebody who's working with students, can you just share with the audience what it's like to be a first-generation college student and the added level of difficulty that is a part of going into college without having somebody in your immediate family who can help you navigate the process?
I'm getting teary, but honestly, it's difficult. It really is difficult because it was a challenge, at least letting my parents know, hey, I'm even if I'm not going off to college, I'm still living with them. But the whole idea of like taking night classes, and it's like, what do you mean night classes? You know, why are you coming home late? You know, and it was like, well, I'm not going to family parties because I have to do homework. It was just like things that obviously no one in my family understood. And I felt like, well, Upward Bound is telling me this is okay, but why is my family saying that's not? And so it took me a while to kind of understand, okay, what is it that I truly want? I know it's going to cost me. And essentially, I kind of gave a presentation out yesterday for our students about how taking good care of yourself means a lot. So like self-care, but also, you know, being that chain breaker in your family. And the way we're doing that now is them, you know, they're being present in these workshops. They're here investing 6 weeks of their time into the program that's going to help them succeed. And so I think it's definitely, I tell them how it's going to be. You know, it's difficult being the first generation, but regardless of how difficult, how scary it might be, never be afraid to raise your hand because someone is going to be there to help you. Definitely have a support system, and we always let them know, like, even if you go off to college, you're more than welcome, and we encourage it, actually promote it, for them to come back and say, hey, I want to be a tutor, or I have a question or something. So we're always there even after they leave.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you all for being with us today. We really appreciate hearing about your experiences in the program. And Ben, thank you so much for sharing a little bit about the impact Upward Bound is having on students.
Thank you, Kathleen, for having us.
The Fresno writer and journalist Mark Arax's new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust in California, has been out for a couple of months now. And it's getting rave reviews. I spoke with him in our studio when it first hit the bookstores. Now that it's the 4th of July weekend and you might be looking for a long summer read, we're going to replay that conversation. There's a romance or bravado to your writing that makes it seem as if everything you're describing was almost predestined. And the best example of that comes in the prologue. So why don't you start by reading a part of that?
The farmer corralled the snow melt and erase the valley, its desert and marsh. He leveled its hog wallows, denuded its salt brush, and killed the last of its mustang, antelope, and tule elk. He emptied the sky of millions of geese and drained the 800 square miles of Tulare Lake dry. He did this first in the name of wheat, then beef, milk, raisins, cotton, and nuts. Once he finished grabbing the flow of the five rivers that ran across the plain, he used his turbine pumps to seize the water beneath the ground. As he bled the aquifer dry, he called on government to bring him an even mightier river from afar. Down the great aqueduct, By freight of politics and gravity came the excess waters of the Sacramento River. The farmer commanded the distant flow. The more water he took, the more crops he planted, and the more crops he planted, the more water he needed to plant more crops, and on and on.
There's a lot of stories in your book about how farmers get water, how they sell it, how the big farmers drill deeper to access groundwater that other smaller farmers can't. You write, water isn't the equalizer that the state and federal water projects promised. Water is the means by which the Valley has become one of the most unequal places on Earth.
You know, one of the things I do at the Valley is, the Valley isn't one place. It's not one valley. It's at least three valleys, if not four. An east side that's the citrus belt, and then a center valley where the raisins and the grapes grow. And I think the center valley is the one that comes the closest to an agrarian ideal. And the distribution of water is more or less equal there. Each of these places has a different relationship to water, and that relationship makes for a different place. So when you go to the east side and you see these communities that were built around water, you see the children of farm workers going to school with the children of farmers. That's one kind of place. Then you go to the west side where there's where the culture of water is really a culture of extraction, and the water is in the hands of a few. So if you go to Kern County, and we see the most extreme example of that in unequal distribution, if you go to Western Kern, you will find the Empire of Wonderful, which is owned by Stuart and Linda Resnick. They are the farmers who live in Beverly Hills and then come up and over the mountain and farm the valley. And you also see that in Corcoran, where the Boswells control 15% of the Kings River. That's an ungodly amount of water. How did they own that? Well, if you trace these things back, you'll find that, one, they bought the rights in these early canal companies that were diverting those rivers. And so by buying those rights, they were able to divert that water and control it, and literally own it.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the word control, because the other example is the Resnick's Wonderful Company and how they manipulated the system to get access to a big chunk of the Kern Water Bank. And you have a great scene in your book where you kind of describe sort of the nuttiness of water in California, where they actually can use some of that water to sell back to the state.
So the problem with farming in Western Kern is there's really no groundwater to speak of. So much farming here in the valley is dependent on the rivers first, and then once the river flow, you know, has problems, then you go into the earth and you pump groundwater. Western Kern doesn't have that. So for Resnick to grow, he had to acquire this Kern water bank. And he did it in a backroom deal in Monterey. And it's still very controversial today. So in the wet years of 2005 and 2006, Resnick had more water than even his trees could drink. So much water came down the aqueduct that he could afford to sell some of the surplus from the water bank. These weren't farm-to-city transfers. This was public water he was selling back to the state through a program called the Environmental Water Account. Its purpose on paper struck a noble note. With water marketing now in vogue, farmers were encouraged to sell surplus water back to the state to help endangered fish in the Delta. Never mind that these same fish were being imperiled by state pumps working overtime to satisfy the demands of farmers. This program allowed Resnick to masquerade as an environmentalist while raiding California's ecological kitty. He was paying the state anywhere from $28 to $86 an acre foot for the water he deposited in the bank. He was then selling this water back to the state and the fish for $200 an acre foot. The trade not only generated $38 million in profits for Resnick, he was able to offer some of the cheap surplus water to independent nut growers as an inducement to process their almonds and pistachios with him. The water bank had become an instrument to further his monopoly.
amazing. And that took place when before the last huge drought. And there's some great scenes in with your reporting where you're tracking down people, knocking on doors. At one point, I remember you find Stuart Resnick at an event in Visalia where you're not invited, actually. And he looks at you with that kind of quizzical indifference that the really wealthy give to people who aren't forwarding their interest. And I wonder what it's like for you as a son of the San Joaquin Valley to confront, if you will, the issues and people of Big Ag.
Several years before, Resnick had invited me into his mansion after reading The King of California and telling me that he thought that I should write a book about him. And I wasn't sure what to call it, The Second King of California. So we had this long interview, and then he got busy and I got busy, and it never happened. So as I'm starting the Dreamtland, I'm trying to figure out what he's up to, he doesn't want to meet. So I end up tracking him down to this pistachio conference in Visalia. I wasn't invited, but they had these pistachio green annual reports, thick ones. And I grabbed one from a trash can, dusted it off. There was a little coffee stain on it, actually, and walked in like I was invited. I went and wanted to talk to him about this secret pipeline.
That he was using during the drought.
That he was using during the drought to keep his trees alive.
And essentially he was piping water from two counties over.
That's right, that's right. Pumping water out of the ground in a place where the land was sinking because of so much pumping. And then he had teamed up with another billionaire, and they used canals and a pipeline to then send that water to Kern County and Resnick's fields. And he looked at me, and obviously he didn't recognize me from years before, and then I tried to explain who I was, and he just kind of, his publicist came.
His people.
His people came, saw that the boss needed help, needed rescuing, and she whisked him out of there, and off he went. Of course, later in the book, you see that I do track him down. In fact, he calls me and wants to meet, and that's the epilogue of the book.
And yet he still evades that question.
Yes.
Pipeline.
Yeah.
But what is it like for you to confront these issues and these people, having grown up here, having a very interesting history here? Your family's been here for decades, farm family at first.
You know, this is a place not only puzzling to me, but it's a mystery to almost all of us who live here. It's a place that doesn't want to confront its history. And the farmers, you know, their reflex is to hide. I remember when I was doing The King of California, one of the huge farmers in the Tulare Lake Basin, the Salyer family, Fred Salyer told me that he was quite happy to die with his history on his pillow.
In case you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm talking to writer Mark Arax about his new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. You write an awful lot about the sinking of the land or subsidence due to deep pumps sucking up water from the aquifer. There's a place called Red Top in Madera where you take us. The rate of subsidence there is more than any other place in the world. Tell us a little bit about Red Top.
What I try to do in this book is I try to bring three things to bear. One is the history of this place, and I tell that through these characters, from Father Sarah to John Sutter to Henry Miller to Isaac Friedlander, the 6'7", you know, wheat king. And then I weave that in, that history, with the reporting on the land and the talking to people, and then my own story, my own family story. And so when I go to Red Top, I don't just see Red Top as a place that's sinking. I see it as a place where I did time. I mean, I was in high school with a crew of my friends. We were all football players. We went out to Red Top to weed the sugar beet fields. You know, a pretty miserable job. And so as I'm documenting this subsidence, I'm also telling the story of that summer in 1976, 75, and of confronting these weeder geese. It's kind of funny. I knew this dirt when it was sugar beets. This is where my high school buddies and I took jobs one summer with a company called Sunfruit Limited, which seemed more apropos of a grower of plums and peaches, not sugar beets and cotton. We were paid the minimum wage to wield long-handled hoes and trudge up and down the quarter-mile rows of beets, looking for weeds. We were a poor excuse for farm workers, though we didn't know it yet. The crew boss let us go at our own pace for a week or two, perhaps thinking we would find our way to usefulness after a suitable period of breaking in. Our third week there, he drove up and unloaded from the back of his truck a bunch of cages holding some kind of species of bird that he let out on the rows next to ours. Weeder geese, he announced, a whole battalion of them. I never knew such a bird existed. We were in decent enough shape for 17-year-old boys, most of us training for our senior year of football. The plan was to work the fields for a month or two and then quit in late August when double-day practices began. What none of us had factored in was the arrival of the geese. They'd been bred with a streak of mean and an appetite for weeds that could not be quenched. That first day, they laid down an immediate challenge. We could either follow their lead or be put to shame by it. We stopped talking, leaned forward into the earth, and locked onto each of our rows. It was 105 in the sun, and the thick coating of sulfur that dusted the waist-high beets turned into a vapor that made everything smell more rotten than it was. That first week, up against the birds, was a blur. This wasn't mowing and edging the front yard and hula-hoeing the courtyard. Field labor took a grit that suburbia had not conditioned us for. Honking and hissing, the geese had no quit. Day after day, our defeat became a mockery. Sulfured faces, dripping lines of sweat, we began to plot against the birds. Taking them on at close range was out of the question. They were the perfect size to go right after our privates. Since I played quarterback, the long-distance assault was led by me. The heavy soil of Red Top produced a high-quality dirt clod. One by one, we started picking off the birds. Not enough to kill or maim them, but enough to let them know that they couldn't get ahead of us without feeling it. When our 6 weeks of labor was finished and we walked off the sugar beet fields and onto the gridiron at Bullard High, we'd been made better by the birds, or so we thought. Then a 5-5 season made us question how we'd spent our summer and more. In all my drives through the fields in the years that followed, I don't think I ever saw another crew of weeder geese. With the rise of Monsanto's Roundup, I believe the birds finally came to understand the agony of defeat. In the move from row crops to permanent crops, the geese were the first workers to be idled.
It's kind of a metaphor for the way agriculture in the valley has evolved, right?
Yeah.
The bigger, the better, the stronger, the more likely that you'll succeed.
That bending of water that began with the gold rush, okay? Because the mining of gold was really the mining of water. So when you see how we then turned the mountain into these flumes, and those flumes took the rivers, and then the flumes connected to these hydraulic hoses, which was the beginning of hydraulic engineering. That bending then became a bending of the rivers when the gold rush ended, and the next boom was the fields of the Central Valley. That bending that took place in the mountain became a culture that was then transplanted down into the valley floor.
So your book, it's a mixture of investigative reporting, history, memoir, even warning, forewarning. How do you, as a reporter, organize this wealth of research? Do you go chapter by chapter, or did you finish all of the reporting before you started writing the book?
First of all, you have to have a huge capacity to fool yourself, because at the outset, you would never tell yourself that this is going to take 6 years. So you tell yourself it's going to take 2 years. And then you go out with a tape recorder and notebook, fill them up, transcribe. You know, it's wonderful to have tapes, you know, because you can really hear things again. But then you have to transcribe those tapes. And sometimes you transcribe so many that you get carpal tunnel syndrome. You say, well, this is going to take me a little bit longer. And so you go a little deeper. And you may do a little writing along the way. And the transcribing, in a way, becomes some writing. And you fool yourself again, telling yourself, well, I'm not really writing. Because, you know, when you're really writing, it's like, oh, gosh, I'm really writing. So you fool yourself along the way. And some of the best writing you do is when you're transcribing those tapes, and then you're freed up and you start doing some riffs. You outline the book. I outline the book. That outline, when I look back on it, I do it all in pen and paper. You find that maybe 80% of it holds. But then that other 20%, those are the surprises, where the reporting takes you in a place you never thought, and the storytelling, the writing, takes you to places you never thought.
Okay, now I'm dying to ask. Tell me one of those surprises.
I found a field man who gave me a tip, and that tip led to this secret pipeline, and that secret pipeline then led back to not only one billionaire, Resnick, but a second billionaire, a guy named Vidovich. So that was a surprise. There's so many surprises along the way. And then the writing is a surprise. You know, I never thought that, as a kind of metaphor, would be our last ranch across the San Joaquin River. And yet that pulls at the narrative throughout. And the book ends on that last ranch, where had my father stayed there, our whole lives might have been different.
I'm wondering, is history teaching us anything?
At the end of the book, I have this late-night visit from all the characters in this book, you know, from Father Sarah to Muir to Henry Miller to J.G. Boswell. And it's where I'm trying to reckon with that history. And you can see from the 1920s, to today, not much has changed. Back in the 20s, the farmers in the valley had used up their rivers. Those were all, you know, the flow of those rivers was all allocated. Then in 1920, the turbine pump was invented and allowed them to go deeper in the earth. And they did, and the ground was sinking back then. That was the cry for steal us a river. And they stole this part of the flow of the Sacramento, shipped it here, and then took the flow of the San Joaquin and shipped it south. So here I am in the midst of the 2015 drought, and the same cry of Dust Bowl is happening, and the same cry of steal us another river is happening. Damn the San Joaquin once more. It's already been dammed 6 or 7 times in its upper reaches. Once down below, there's no more water to give to a dam. So you can see that in 100 years, just in that time period, nothing had changed.
So what does this mean for the future of California? What does all this reporting tell you about what's going to happen in the next century?
Just like we overdeveloped suburbia, we've overdeveloped the farm belt. We started with primo land, and then we went to marginal land. And now we're farming poor land, and something has to give. We're farming 6 million acres in the San Joaquin Valley, and when the groundwater regulations, the new law, takes effect, and all of it shakes out, I think we're going to be farming 4 million acres. 2 million acres will go back to fallowed land, and some of the water saved will go back into the rivers for the environment, and some of it will go to other farmers who are farming better land.
But that won't take effect for a couple of decades, right?
It'll be at least 15 more years, but those decisions are already happening now. And it'll be painful. There'll be lots of lawsuits. What I'm hoping is that smaller, smarter ag is able to sustain itself, and that small and medium-sized farmers will still have a role. When I'm about finished with all my travels and I find this farmer in Madera, and I call him the Oracle because that's how he's served. He's been an oracle for me for years. And we go on the land, and he shows me these places that have been planted in almonds and pistachios that should have never been farmed. And he says those will be the first places where the farm will go fallow. And he talks about the craziness of the system and the craziness of the banking policies and all of this kind of madness that has led to this overdevelopment of the farm belt. It's quite a moving scene.
Well, that's probably a good place to end.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in, Mark.
Thank you, Alice.
And now it's time for the weekend. I recently told you about Boyden Cavern. It's reopened for tours 3 years after damage from the Rough Fire made it inaccessible. But just who makes these tours possible? For that answer, I'm going to take you behind the stalactites, scenes, to meet them. At the cave, it's a multi-sensory experience. You feel a drop in temperature, hear the sound of a creak, and... yes, a baby. That's 7-month-old Calvin, who right now is trying to grab the microphone.
Yep. It's all a goal to get it to the mouth.
And that's his mom, Maria Baker.
Sometimes he's just kind of hanging out back behind the cash register and people will come in and we'll just be having a conversation and then he'll make a noise or something and they go, oh, there's a baby in here.
Maria was pregnant with Calvin when she and her husband Daniel got the call last year.
It was kind of like, is this real?
The concessionaire needed someone to reopen the cavern after the Rough Fire destroyed its bridges. Daniel weighed the options.
For what I was doing, and I was making good money. Wasn't sure if I wanted to leave that with all the benefits and just the good pay that I had.
Daniel was a welder. Maria worked for Fresno County. Did they want to give up these 9-to-5 jobs in exchange for running the only cave tour in the giant Sequoia National Monument? Yes. After all, the cave was where they met in 2012. Maria had just moved to California from Illinois and taken a job as a tour guide. Daniel also worked there at the time.
Besides the manager, I was the first one down here because it was my second year, and she was the first new employee hired.
I do remember my first day, obviously also because it was the first day that I drove down here, and the views are just spectacular, amazing. Every time I rounded a corner, I was like, oh, whoa, just like amazed.
Daniel says they had some trouble with bears that year. They would visit staff homes in the forest.
Probably the second or third night was the, she called it the telltale scratching. And it was just, after that, I was like, man, she's kind of goofy.
Maria calls it a summer camp romance. They even wanted to get married here.
But unfortunately, when we came down in 2016, that was the first time we saw all of the damage from the Rough Fire. So we realized we couldn't do it actually at the cave.
So they got married at the Fresno courthouse. But Boyden was always in the back of their minds.
We always used to talk about how cool it would be to run Boyden when we worked here and never really thought that it would be a possibility.
It's a dream job, she says, for a couple who met here and now have a family. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR News team, Alice Daniel, Monica Velez,
Carrie Klein, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.